Hello, everyone. My name is Taylor.
And I'm Kelly.
And we are the co-hosts of Jumping Bomb Audio, the number one show all about the world of Joshi Pro Wrestling. Every other Monday, we're coming at you with news, show reviews, and previews of upcoming Joshi action.
So whether you're just getting into the scene or you've seen it all, this is the show for you.
Check us out on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network and wherever you get your audio.
Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too. This week in the news, updates on Jim Ross and Pat McAfee. In the lazy river of criticism, a preview of Night of Champions. No Vader Club this week. It was just kind of a light week for everybody. I am Jeff Hawkins. He is Chris Novembrino. I'm going to throw some knowledge Chris's way that's in his wheelhouse so he can talk for a little bit. We are a music show, partially as well, so attention must be paid. Rest in peace to guitarist Mick Ralphs. Chris, do you recognize that name if I say it?
No, who do you play with?
Mick Ralphs is the original lead guitarist for a band I really liked called Bad Company.
Okay, sure.
He was also the lead guitarist for a group called Mott the Hoople.
And
his songwriting credits include Feel Like Making Love with Paul Rodgers, Ready for Love, Can't Get Enough, Good Love and Gone Bad from Bad Company's first couple of albums. He was also the lead guitar player on that riff from All the Young Dudes, the song that David Bowie wrote for Mott the Hoople. If I said All the Young Dudes, do you know what
this is a guy whose guitar parts I know how to play. One of those guys, and I think guys are always impressive.
It's very, I would say Bach, maybe Mozart, is that All the Young Dudes is a phenomenal song. It really is. It's one of my favorites. But
the way you sang it, it sounded like Palisades Park.
I know. Look, I don't. Look. I don't sing like an electric guitar. So there you go. But actually, while I'm listing his equipment, you go listen to the opening to Mott the Hoople. The Young Dudes. With Mott the Hoople, he had a Gibson Les Paul Jr., a Gibson Firebird single pickup, Gibson SG, and a Fender Telecaster. Bad Company, Fender Telecaster, Fender Stratocaster, Gibson Les Paul Standard, Fender Esquire, Gibson Flying V. And of late, he had been using a Fender Stratocaster fitted with a two-tech bridge. I have no idea what that means, do you?
A two-tech bridge?
Two-tech. Two-tech.
Oh, it's got to be like a brand of bridge. I've never used it, but maybe it's a whammy bar bridge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Guitar talk only here on Shake Them Ropes. But yeah, Bad Company is one of those great bands that, you know, a lot of their credit goes to their lead singer, and I love their lead singer. I think Paul Rodgers has one of the most fantastic voices in rock. Also played with Queen for a while. Not Mick Rouse, but Paul Rodgers was the lead singer of Queen for a while. He was also part of that super group in the 80s with Jimmy Page called The Firm with Chris Slade on drums from AC/DC and Manfred Mann's Earth Band. But no, Mick Rouse.
We were talking about these type of bands before the show. These are bands where you had an incredible assemblage of personnel and no songs to match the amount of people you had in the band.
They had a minor hit with a song called Radioactive, but yeah, they kind of flew out. Yeah, it's one of these weird things, like in the 80s, all these classic rock guys tried to get down to make like super groups, and some of them hit and some of it, like the only one that I really know of that really hit in the 80s, per se, and this might be late 80s, this might even be 90s, now that is Damn Yankees.
Yeah, Damn Yankees. They're late 80s. Like 88.
That's John Waite. I'm thinking Bad English also. John Waite in Bad English as well. Yeah. He of the 80s and whatnot. Yeah.
But you know, it's like, I feel like a lot of those 80s super groups in particular are real testimony. If you don't have songs, it doesn't matter who the personnel is. Like, why does Traveling Wilburys work? Because, like, Handle With Care's a good song.
Yeah. But, End of the Line is a good song.
Right. So. Yeah. But, you know, they also had, I don't know, four songwriters there and two songs.
Well, you also had, I mean, you had Jeff Lynne, who produced every album in the 80s of all these guys like Tom Petty and George Harrison, all their singles works, too. So, I mean, yeah. Okay. I thought you knew Mott the Hoople, All the Young Dudes, so I was expecting you to go, oh, that guitar part, yeah, that's iconic.
It's no, like, whereas I more think of, honestly, the bar rock standards, like Can't Get Enough of Your Love and those sorts of things. Feel Like Making Love. I mean, these are... they are so emblematic of a bar band of a certain generation who...
Yes. Yes.
Like when I was learning guitar, I always knew that was sort of like yesteryear's bar band in the year 2004, but you still learned those songs. And then, like, you know, also in college and stuff, I'd be listening to Replacements live stuff and they'd be burning through a bunch of these Bad Company style riffs and that sort of thing too. And, you know, you begin also, I have since played in the Boomer Rock Band with like 60-year-old guys where they want to run through basically this canon of songs. And yeah, Mick Rouse, his songs come up a lot in that. And I mean, something to be said for writing anything that's got staying power 50 years later.
That's true. Oh, here's a piece of trivia I did not know. David Bowie originally wrote Suffragette City for Mott the Hoople. And then Mott the Hoople told him, thanks. It's not our brand of song. And also we broke up. And so David Bowie calls up and goes, okay, I got this idea for this song called All the Young Dudes and blah, blah, blah. And then they record it. It becomes their biggest hit. And it keeps the band together for a few more years.
I know. And Suffragette City absolutely would have fit right in with their other stuff.
I wonder if he played guitar on Suffragette City. I didn't. They didn't list it, so I doubt it.
No, I think it's the other guy that Bowie used a lot. The one who had the very mid-focused, almost like harmonics-generating distortion. I forget his name, though. Ronson? Mick Ronson?
That sounds right there. Well, let's get to the wrestling talk. We've ticked off whoever long enough. Jim Ross provided an update on his battle back from cancer on his podcast twice this week. Second time he announced he had been checked, and he was cancer-free. Good for him. Thank Tony Khan for his support and said he'd like to work it all in Texas. Quote, I'm tired of sitting at home. I'm excited about the opportunities that await. I am feeling better. My plan is to be in Dallas for the big event. He wants to call Omega and Okada. You always want to be near or attached to the big events that the company you're working for is promoting. I'm excited about the opportunity to get back in the saddle and kick some ass at some of these events. I'm feeling better. Yes, this is why I cheered so hard for the cancer being gone, because now I have to go, all right, JR, you've lost a lot on your fastball here, kid. And I love you.
He's
turning into Gordon Solie, where Gordon Solie just would not want to give up calling play-by-play. And you're just
On one hand, it's like, You know, it's the way I feel with Frankie Valli, where it's like I want people, even in their twilight years, to be happy and do what they want to do with their lives. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I also would love to find a way to do that where I don't have to watch you suck. And that's the real agony here. Is how do we get Frankie Valli on stage without people having to watch him be bad? How do we keep JR happy without having to listen to him? Can we put him in a box and pretend that he's doing commentary? Can we do an alternative JR commentary option for those who want the JR call? Is there some other way around this?
Well,
bluntly, I have no interest in hearing JR call play-by-play anymore. As you said, he's lost his fastball, so I want him to be happy and healthy, but he stinks on commentary now, and he has for about half a decade.
Well, he can't get into character, and that's
because he doesn't know the product well enough.
That and also...
He doesn't know who the guys are. He has to get coached along on who the guys are. He has to get coached along on who the stories are, and he still has... And he still has the same problem with this AEW product that he had with WWE's product, which is that it's not his wrestling. It's not what he likes to call, and it doesn't even lend itself to the JR style of call. So while I get that he misses calling wrestling, he misses calling a wrestling that currently, to my chagrin to a certain extent, is not on TV right now.
No, that's true. I have a similar corollary in my life. I went to an improv show for the first time in ages last night. And there was one phenomenal group, and there was one group that wasn't so great. I could feel myself getting into coaching mode on the group that didn't have a great show necessarily, and I could feel like I'm getting sucked out of being an audience member and I'm becoming a critic. And watching this as a coach and going, this is what's technically wrong with this stuff. And that's kind of what happens with JR. Even early, because I just watched an early episode of AEW Dynamite. And this was our critique of him then, was he's watching like he's a talent relations guy, as opposed to being the play-by-play guy who's fully immersed in this world and playing the part of the play-by-play guy for a fictional wrestling company kind of.
But I also think that a sharper JR, if we could wind the mental clock 30 years back, right? I still think that JR would have a lot of the same frustrations with the narrative inconsistencies and incongruencies that you and I have been articulating, that I riffed on at length on the last episode. The dots not fully connecting. He would have, go back to 90s JR. When dots didn't connect, he'd always make that little snarky comment about this, that, or the third. And there's a lot of that right now. And I think he would be... If he was sharper, he would be frustrated by that. Why does the Hurt Syndicate do this? Why aren't the Death Riders doing that? What does the EVP, or what power does the EVP have? Am I really supposed to call the EVP titles like a belt? Is this another one of their 15, 16 belts? What, you know, like, he would be asking those questions, whether on mic or off mic, backstage. And I think that would get under people's skin.
Pat McAfee has been off Raw for the past 3 weeks. No reason given by WWE. He's expected back imminently, but he basically said, hey, I needed a few weeks off to recharge. Quote, continuing to just like catch up on life as a whole, post Money in the Bank, pre-Night of Champions, felt like a good time. I was getting pretty exhausted there. So shout out to everybody, to WWE looking out for me too. Very, very thankful. Yes, this guy still does 3 hours a day on ESPN Live as a talk show. He still does the football. He has a small child. He is burning the candle at 16 ends at once. And I like Pat McAfee. I think he was getting a little overexposed. I like when he takes breaks, because then he comes back a little bit rejuvenated, a little bit ready to be a little bit dialed in, as opposed to just kind of making, again, he has that little JR making snarky remarks about things that he's watching at times too. So I mean,
well, and I think this is just good practice for WWE to get into with all their commentary team at this point. You know, especially in a post Vince world, they have a very solid roster of call play-by-play guys and color guys right now. You got Joe Tessitore, you got Vic, you got Michael Cole. I mean, you have a number of really solid options, and so you can give any one of those people a week off and rotate any one of the color guys around. I mean, who wouldn't love to hear 3 hours of Booker T on Raw?
I was waiting for that. I'm like, does he realize that? Yes, it has a solid roster. And Booker T.
And Booker T is also part of that roster.
Yes, he is a guy who does color commentary.
There's other guys. There's that Velocity show I never watch, and the other
Speed.
Show. Speed. Yep, that one. It's one of my favorites.
Look, we can't totally clown on Booker T because he does help get a lot of things over. He does get stuff over.
I know.
It's so weird, isn't it? I am so annoyed by him.
You can't say he didn't help get Trick Williams over. And it's annoying as hell.
Everybody does the during the Stephanie Vaquer Devil's kiss now.
Yep. And I mean, people call out to Booker. I mean, he is an integral part of that brand's sort of like crowd engagement identity right now, for good or for ill. I don't love it, but it works. It's clearly effective in some cases.
Power outage in Riyadh took the SmackDown live feed down for about 30 minutes. They retaped some of those segments that were going on. When they went down, they were in the middle of Cody and Randy Orton cutting a promo. So the taped version today will probably be slightly different. It eventually came back on, and I watched the rest of what the live feed was. I'll be interested to see what they do within there. Spoiler alert, if you want earmuffs, Julia is now your United States Women's Champion. I thought that was a fairly decent match, but might be one more match I talk about in the Lazy River. We'll get to that. Injuries. The Raw angle where Penta laid out Chad Gable and gave him the arm breaker was a blow-off, because Gable found out he's going to need shoulder surgery, and they did use that as a cover angle. So that's bad news, because that guy had a gimmick that was working. It was getting up there. Dominic Mysterio is going to have some time off with a rib injury, and Kevin Owens updated his status. He had not gotten his neck surgery yet. They were trying to see how well the spine would heal, and he says there's been, up until about last week, it was fine, and then he started getting those tingles down the arm and whatnot, so they're going to be holding off until it gets a little bit stronger. You look like you want to say something, so I'll let you get in here.
Well, Gable's an interesting one in the sense that he's been doing a lot, mm-hmm. but I also kind of felt like the story wasn't necessarily going to that next area or getting to right. that next level. And so maybe, you know, this is sort of like a blessing in disguise. Obviously never good to need surgery, but now he's developed out a new character. If he wants, he can kind of come back as El Gran Americano and use that as part of the re-debut and kind of re-debut really hot. Or he could come back as a babyface and be very hot too, because his performance throughout all of this has been so strong that the crowd's going to be very excited to either see him back and cheer for him or see him back and boo him again.
Right.
And I don't think it's necessarily the worst thing in the world for the Brothers Creed. Ivy Nile is maybe the big loser in all of this, because I think she really benefited from having the stable the most out of all of them.
I actually think the Brothers Creed are in trouble here too, because it tends to be one of those things. Like, I mean, we've already seen when Gable was around, they weren't using him all that much. I mean, they'll bring them in, they'll have a banger of a match, but the character development's kind of weak. You know, Brutus is, not Brutus, but Julius is dressing in some rather strange denim inspired wear. You know, they're, it's almost like they're acting out a little bit.
Right. Well, I mean, the other thing is maybe, okay, one, move them to SmackDown where you got a really deep tag roster and they can have some fresh matches. Two, have them ease off the Bald Eagle America 4th of July everyday brother sort of approach to whatever their characterization is. Let's go back to kind of more of the Diamond Mine sort of mentality of like these are collegiate style athletes who believe in sort of a very tough, grindy form of training. Maybe this is a good time, especially with no quarter catch crew falling apart at the seams in every single direction. Bring up Dempsey and have him be a new member in that group. Refresh him as, again, scrappier stretchers rather than, and then also now you have Charlie Dempsey, one more reason to get away from the rah-rah America crap. It's El Gran Americano, you and I both like. I think it's an effective gimmick. I don't think the other America hyper-patriotic stuff was really getting anywhere near as much effectiveness as the El Gran Americano gimmick. I mean, really, if you want to distill it all down, you could just kind of keep that off to the side and do something else with the main trio.
That'll do it for the news. Now to the lazy river of wrestling criticism, whatever we watched, whatever we had time for. We will start on the beach with a preview of Night of Champions live from Saudi Arabia. Six matches announced thus far. Most of them seem to be fairly cut and dry to me, but I think it's still going to be... something has to happen on this show because it's one of their big major business partners. They're bringing the Rumble down there. I thought maybe cash in for Money in the Bank, but I don't think so. But we'll see. I think the cash in for the men's happening on Saturday night's main event with Goldberg. I think Goldberg beats Gunther, and then or Gunther gets hammered by Goldberg enough where Seth comes down and cashes in. So, but we'll see. Sami Zayn versus Karrion Kross. Karrion Kross finally on a major pay-per-view card. Good for him. Really good with his mouth. Been cutting really great promos, I think, on Raw. Deserves it. But it's so weird because it feels like Karrion Kross has to win to keep the story going. But I think the story is going to be he's going to sucker Sammy into doing something brutal so he'll be, quote-unquote, in control.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... Like, the problem with this match in front of this crowd is that Sami Zayn is such a dominant babyface character, generally speaking, but especially in front of Saudi Arabia historically, mm-hmm. that I don't necessarily think they're going to see the nuance in the, oh, he used a steel chair on the outside, or, oh, he threw him through a table. Like, they're just going to be like, hell yeah, Sammy, beat up that guy. This is their guy beat up not their guy. You know, they're not going to see it with this depth or nuance.
Oh,
or,
he did the hell of a kick through Scarlett into Karrion Kross.
Right. Even something as absurd as that, which, you know, WWE is going to do. I just, like, if Scarlett, you know, like, got, like, knocked into the barricade or whatever, I don't think that does anything.
No, it
has no effect on the Saudi Arabia audience.
That's kind of my point, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm even using an absurd limit case. Even then, I still can't get my brain to see them biting on that. So I think that's like the flaw here. And we're going to talk more about Saudi Arabia as like a show, as a heel character, I guess a lot here on this episode. The flaw here to me is like, you just got to have Sammy win. But the story is so much better if Kross either wins or, as you said, Kross somehow gets Sammy to like cross a clear line during the course of this match, but it's just impossible to imagine what that would look like.
Rhea Ripley taking on Raquel Rodriguez in a street fight. I think it'll be good, don't get me wrong, but
look, obviously. They just had to do something with the loss of Liv Morgan, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I could see a way where Roxanne Perez helps Raquel Rodriguez win here.
Me too. I think actually, like,
but I don't think that happens. I think Rhea overcomes both. That's what I think happens here.
I think that might very well be the case because these shows are meant to be feel good for Saudi Arabia, but I'm kind of with you. In a weird way, Liv being removed, a bit of a blessing in disguise narratively, yes, for the Judgment Day, because it makes this Roxanne Raquel thing a much more even dynamic and like a complicated one, like, because they were a former tag team and they've alluded to that before and they have history and distrust of one another, and Roxanne's now trying to win over Raquel's trust, and Raquel now, before, Raquel was kind of like the secondary to Liv, and here now Raquel is kind of the dominant figure to Roxanne, who's trying to butter her up, and it makes the dynamic a lot more interesting. I hope they have Raquel win. Just because I think that spices up things a lot in the Judgment Day stable. But I'm kind of with you. I think Rhea might.
Well, Raquel left her laying, so WWE booking says that Rhea gets it back. Another one that's fairly obvious, but I'll have to say it after I say the match. Jacob Fatu versus Solo Sikoa for the United States Championship. Jacob Fatu's probably going to win this with the help of Jimmy Uso, given what happened on SmackDown tonight. I'll say this, though, and I said this last week as well. Solo Sikoa is getting some very oddly amusing to me charisma in this run where he's already an afterthought kind of thing, but he's really started to learn how to play up the 1960s Batman villain aspects of his character.
He's so much more interesting on the microphone than Solo, yes, Sikoa, because than Jacob Fatu, because with Jacob Fatu, I'm counting down the seconds before he prattles off another one of his Roman Reigns, the big dog suffering succotash phrases.
Yeah.
Because they've loaded him up with every possible, like, something, all gas, no brakes, you know, know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then there's another couple in there too. But like, yeah, I mean, and he basically every paragraph is just a little trot through the woods until we get back to his catchphrase again. And Solo Sikoa's speaking real words that don't necessarily go in the most predictable fashion that I'm expecting them to go.
Yeah, it's in protecting Jacob Fatu as a guy they see as a star, they're hurting him by putting him in catchphrase land. You're exactly right about that. It's we need this call and response to make him a star, so we're going to shove that down your guys' throats over and over again. That could end up backfiring in some ways. I'm with you on that.
Yeah, it just gets tedious because I see things with him.
Yes.
When he's just speaking. But they've over-gimmicked him. He has a certain aura, but they've over-gimmicked him. It's like
over-gimmicking him takes away the aura of realism from the streets that he brings into this, that element of danger that he has. It's almost like you're domesticating a wild animal in some ways, you know.
And he's also doing like the hello fellow kids thing that they've got 40-year-old Jey Uso doing too.
Yes.
Where, yeah, like, and with Uso, it works better because he's more youthful looking. But with Jacob Fatu, trying to sell me that this guy's like, you know, in his early 20s, he did not look it. You know, he got Arn Anderson syndrome. He looks like an old man. He's been looking like an old man. He's going to look like an old man his entire career. He's going to be fit. He's going to be a monster. But like, don't sell him to me as fellow kids. Sell him to me as a man in his prime who is scary.
Yes. Yeah, that yeah, no, you're exactly right. We don't need a second Bron Breakker on SmackDown. We need Jacob Fatu.
Right.
King and Queen of the Ring tournament finals. Queen of the Ring first, Asuka versus Jade Cargill.
Jade.
It's gonna be Jade,
but boy,
Asuka,
I think the better question
to do.
Yeah, the better question throughout this tournament has been, should it be Jade? Because, ugh, good
for,
lord.
For storyline purposes, yes. For match purposes,
oh,
no.
Goodness. I it's like her, like she's just not been very sharp lately.
Well, and then you get into the problem with Asuka, who hasn't been in the ring. What, 2 weeks? Since coming back from like almost a year-long layoff, it's the same problem that they had. And if you watched last week's SmackDown, which we did, and I watched this week's too, the Wyatt Six, once that entrance stops, they stink.
Stink,
Because they haven't been in the ring at all. And it shows that they haven't been in the ring.
It's not even – I know what people are thinking, oh, it's fitness. It's more than that. Like the Wyatt Six is a real good example because like – We're kind of Joe Gacy fans on the show.
Yes,
like in particular, we're kind of Joe Gacy fans. Like he went from being a guy we were kind of on the fence on early on in his run in NXT, and then some of those matches towards the end of his run in NXT, guy was just killing himself. He's good. This team of Loomis and Gacy, they don't know their team chemistry beats, and that's where. Like the lack of them being in the ring on a regular basis really shows. And then like, yeah, I mean, look, the Wyatt Six thing has always been, if there's no continuous sustaining story and kind of a sustaining slow burn narrative focus, like the Wyatt Six needs to be kind of a fixed segment on the show every week. They're always doing a thing. Cause once they get out of view, you're not necessarily rushing to have them back in view again.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they had something interesting when they had the origin of the Wyatt Six, and then they just kind of went away from it for a while, and now it's
right.
Like, okay.
Those origin videos were great.
Yeah, why do we have this spooky group of, five other than to just basically say, we love you, Bray, here's your entrance, and then that's it.
Hey, per last week, I know we brought video packages last week, and people can poo-poo video packages, and I'm not saying this one was ultimately effective in getting this talent over, but can anyone deny how damn good that Eric Rowan promo
right.
video was?
Right.
I mean, look, you're done with someone else, that Eric Rowan promo video absolutely becomes a thing where you latch onto that guy. And you're going all the way with him.
The men's King of the Ring tournament finals, getting into this match, Cody Rhodes and Jey Uso, I thought had a bit of a banger there over on Raw. I am not the biggest Jey Uso fan in the world because I find his matches very patterned in some ways, but I thought Cody and Jey had very, very good chemistry in that match, and it'll be Randy Orton. Okay, I'm here for this. This will be an interesting match in some ways. Who you got winning?
I don't know the King of the Ring really.
Remember,
matters.
Okay, let me give you the stipulation.
What is the stipulation, though?
Winners who are crowned King and Queen of the Ring receive a match for their respective brand's world championship at SummerSlam.
SummerSlam, that's right. I'm going to go Orton.
Really? Okay, because I think it has to be Cody.
Okay.
Because of the stipulation of the world championship, and I think Cody's getting it back at SummerSlam. Or my other possibility, which we'll talk about when we talk about the main.
They've already done Orton Cena. Okay. You see, like originally I was thinking Orton just for the draw factor, like, and. Honestly, you could totally justify doing Orton Cena 2 because Orton Cena 1 hardly scratched the edge of this. It would, you know, Orton Cena 2, because they did such a, in our opinion, piss poor job on Orton Cena 1, if you made Orton Cena 2 the one where John Cena snaps on Orton, that is a money segment.
Put a little pin in there, because we may have to circle back to that when we're talking about this match. For the undisputed WWE Championship, John Cena versus CM Punk. Punk on today's SmackDown came out to John Cena's Thug Life music, except it was called Punk Life. And yes, he was wearing a chain with a lock on it. He had he had the rings on the fist that said drug free, and he did a 7 out of 10. Homage to the John Cena raps of old, if you recall those. I think they took some of the teeth out of what he could have done on these because they were in Saudi Arabia, so there was no real sexual allusions as John Cena would do when he was Thuganomics. This is Punkonomics. Thing.
I'm not going to complain, though. They're both in their 40s. It gets weird and cringy hearing 40-year-old guys talk about their balls.
This was how are you doing, fellow kids, punk in some ways. But thinking about this, because I'm trying to figure out how they get John Cena babyface. And yeah, Cody Rhodes has been chirping about how, man, I think my time as a babyface is almost coming to an end here. And Cody is a really good person at putting BS out there when it's about time to have BS, just so that it's a feint for something else. And you hit it on the head last week, Chris, really hard, and it's got me thinking, is that John Cena's been correct about what an absolute fraud CM Punk has been throughout this whole process, even to the point of now coming to Saudi Arabia, when once he said he did. I'm like, at the rah-rah thing that they do at these big events now in the thing, CM Punk gave an apology to the people of Saudi Arabia.
It was so much more than he had to do.
Yes.
It was so much more than he had to do. And
So allow me to posit this. Instead of being a cash-in, the big surprise at Night of Champions is going to be Dwayne. The Rock is in Saudi Arabia, possibly. And John Cena hasn't mentioned The Rock once during this entire heel run. But the CM could be corporate man, but has he mentioned The Rock?
No, CM Punk has.
But CM Punk has.
Yeah, it's been in the backdrop, but Cena hasn't.
But CM Punk, because he's been getting booed in Saudi Arabia versus, say, John Cena.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
What if CM Punk becomes Dwayne's new man and takes the title off of Cena here, and then you have your Rhodes Punk for the title over here, and Randy, you could have Randy Cena too, where it's like Cena is now a man with no friends, and here comes Randy Orton to say you still have some penance to be had. Don't get me wrong, I think the obvious story is to do Rhodes Cena 2 at SummerSlam, and maybe Rhodes becomes Rock's guy then. But they've been playing that way too far up in the media for me to say, yeah, that's going to be it. I think Punk's the guy to turn, and eventually it becomes a feud with Cody.
Yeah, I don't know that Cena's losing the belt at SummerSlam either. I think it might be a little later on in the year.
Oh, so you have Cena retain here. Okay, I was going to have Punk win here.
Yeah, but no. So I have Cena holding on the belt in my head at least through SummerSlam.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I could see him having it all the way up to like Survivor Series or something like
that. I want to get out of this heel Cena because he's not doing anything.
No, I want that too, but that's separate from my how are they going to really hop off the heel run that quickly, just a Mania to SummerSlam thing. I tend to think no. I tend to think Cena might be our heel champion for the entire calendar year, like through to WrestleMania.
My other note on main roster this week as I watched this SmackDown, yeah, they're going to have this street fight with Raquel and Mommy. But Tiffany Stratton and Nia had a bit of a banger on this one. It was a last woman standing match, and it was not clean at all. It was what we like to call a hot mess, but it was a fun mess, Chris.
Both Nia kind of, you know, famously hit or miss, especially in the opinions of the show.
And when she hits you, she really
hits. And when you hear, yeah, when she hits you, you wish she missed. Miss, I wish you wouldn't hit me. So, but both her and Stratton, I think it's fair to say, have a well-earned reputation of being pretty tough. And so one thing I always enjoy with Stratton in these no-DQ matches is, like, she's not afraid to get down and dirty with
it. Oh, no.
And that's what's always, for me, it's kind of been her most endearing babyface quality. And it's, I think, the thing that WWE as a company's kind of forgotten. She's also kind of suffering from that Jacob Fatu, too many catchphrases thing. The best thing about Tiffany Stratton is she's a Barbie doll looking person who is willing to get gritty and bloody and as tough as anybody else. Underneath the pink hair is a very, very tough human being.
Dare I say, when they go to Riyadh and they have to dress up the hypersexual gear with bodysuits, like Tiffany Stratton, Julia, and Asuka and stuff, I think they come off way better sometimes. I do. I mean, especially, and even Selena Vega was in there, and Selena Vega sometimes has a lack of clothing in her gear, but because it's Saudi Arabia and there's certain standards there, they have to look like superheroes more than objectified wrestlers, and I think it actually helps their aura in some ways with the bodysuits, to be honest with you, but that's just a personal predilection.
I think there's a happy medium, right? I'm with you. It's like, I mean, I for a long time, it's like I've been firmly in the camp of it would be better if they were a little less glammed up, less extensions.
Yes.
I mean,
make them tougher athletes. Make them actual athletes as opposed to.
Yeah. You know, I don't care about, you know, the cultural mores or whatever, but that sort of stuff. But like, I do think my concern is, you know, is it effective? Right. And I think, you know, making every female wrestler super sexualized is not necessarily the most effective presentation for every female wrestler. Hamstrings other tougher wrestlers like a Shayna Baszler, the Queen of Spades type of character, because it's like, how much do you want to stretch out little Barbie or, you know, little cutesy Magoo?
Yeah. I thought especially Vanessa Bourne was always the one that I looked at. If you'd stop dressing her in lingerie and dress her in actual athletic gear, she could be a friggin' wrestler and she'd be awesome at it. But instead it's like, oh, she's, I forgot her nickname, but it was just like, yeah, okay. She's out here in Victoria's Secret wear wrestling and nobody has any respect for her whatsoever. So,
right. Yeah. Because on one hand, you're like, oh, that's going to get her over. And like, don't get me wrong. The first time Vanessa Bohr comes through the curtain, if you're, you know, a red-blooded male, you'll notice her. But does that 4 weeks from now make her more over than she was that first week she went through the curtain? And the answer is no.
Your
then eventually you kind of get a diminished returns thing. All right, let's I guess let us kick it over to you want, man, I thought I had the AEW results. Please give me one. I will go
to AEW then.
Thank you to the wrestling websites for labeling lots of shit's results and then not actually putting any content on them. Yeah, you guys are really good. You're the real jerk.
I will give a very big positive to AEW this week and a question, because the booking was a little strange at times. Especially Hurt Business and Jet Speed, but nevertheless, I thought this Jon Moxley promo was the best of at least this championship run.
Okay, really?
I did, and I'll tell you why.
Why? Yeah, I'm interested in that.
Because it was focused on the one-on-one of the Hangman feud and the kayfabe Hangman character within AEW. There was none of that. I'm here to change the wrestling business and the AEW, you know, that grand, like, you offset this with the Seth Rollins promo, which was just an absolute waste of effing time.
Oh, Seth Rollins character
sucks.
He
sucks.
It's just a miasma of his various characters through the years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the architect, I'm the visionary, I'm the savior of professional wrestling, and I also dress like the Joker, and I dress like an ass. It's every character he's ever done in a watered-down cover band playing the hits version. I hate it.
But if you compare it to this Moxley promo where he's focusing on, look, you're too concerned about your friendships, you're in your feelings. You know, it's all about the stuff that, at least that Hangman showing on character and why Moxley hates that. And then he actually talks about being a champion as opposed to you don't deserve to see this belt because it's in with the, what do you call it, the kitchen cabinet Marina Shafir over here.
When she did come out in her signature halter top.
Yes. But it was actually talking about a bit of a personal issue and about the one-on-one issue as opposed to this esoteric treatise on the state of professional wrestling and how some people want to be entertainers as opposed to tough guys. And also, I think, oddly enough, the location of the promo helped steady him because he wasn't doing the stupid shaking his shoulders and pacing back and forth. He was in a stairwell having to stare at the camera and say his piece. I really liked this promo. It sounds like you disagree with me.
Okay,
no, that's fine.
Yeah, so it is utter non sequitur to everything that the Death Riders has been about. And if anything, the stuff that made this promo effective serves as a critique to the Death Riders. If you think this promo was effective, this is to say that Jon Moxley is more effective as a heel champion by himself in a stairwell than in the ring with his faction that he put together, and this whole storyline that he put together about purging the weakness and all of this stuff. It's like, yeah, in a vacuum, if Jon Moxley hadn't been telling me a completely different story for the last 9 months since he's been champion, oh, this would be great. But then we get into this other thing of Jon Moxley's promo didn't really come off as heelish. It honestly came off, and I kind of dislike this Moxley promo when he goes here as a heel. It was the Moxley grit and grime. I go out there and for years I was in the mud and I was clawing and scratching and clawing and squawing and clatching. I was doing them all. Yes. And you've never done any of that.
Squawing and cratching.
Yes.
Okay. That's the name of the episode. I gotta remember that. Okay.
Squawing and cratching. He was out there squawing and cratching for years. And, you know, emo boy cowboy wasn't. But here's the thing. Like, this part of the problem is that Hangman's emotional fragility is not elevated as a virtuous quality about him. There are some people in the crowd were like, we love our emo cowboy, but it's almost sort of like a jokey thing.
I'll push back on that. I think it is, at least to like Excalibur, who calls, the emo cowboy kind of a thing. It's pushed
as
his gimmick.
He says the emo cowboy, but like his actual empathy, his emotionalness, not the tagline of the emo cowboy. I'm not talking about the big dog quality of Adam Page here. I'm Fair. Talking about, is the dog barking? Not, are we calling him a big dog?
Right.
Right? And the dog doesn't really bark to extend this metaphor here for me. You know, like, yeah, they talk about him being will he or won't he. Oh, he's conflicted about this or that. But honestly, all this emo shit has been a cover-up for inconsistent characterization, especially around Swerve Strickland. Let's not hide the ball on this. You wouldn't have to do this shit if Adam Page hadn't burned down a guy's house inexplicably a year ago and was only somewhat repentant about it. You wouldn't have to get into this, my heart is twisted. What? Who am I? Shit. You're only doing that because of a very questionable booking decision you made a year ago. So I'm not going to act like this is some sort of brilliant piece of writing. This is shitty retro continuity.
I didn't think I'd get you swearing angry. I thought you were just angry at it. Okay, so let me ask this then, because this is the weird part to me, and I'm watching this, and they've already done the Swerve Ospreay put your EVP crap on the line stuff.
I'm going to go on here, though, a little bit more on Paige. Paige and Moxley. I'm not finished.
Okay, go ahead.
Don't believe that Paige is going to win the belt, and Moxley's not threatened by Paige, really. Moxley is so unthreatened by Paige, he's not even surrounded by his guys.
Okay.
Like, your stairwell thing, yeah, no, it's good in the sense that he's not doing – this thing and scratching and clawing, squalling and cratching, all of that, right?
Yeah,
like
yes.
He's not rooting and tooting, he's not squalling and cratching. But like this all belies his calmness is sitting on the stairwell, not being surrounded by his boys, not taking it to that next level because he's really worried about the champion, just belies that he's not actually worried about losing to Adam Page. So that is my final critique on this. That's all I got now.
Okay, because here's where the booking of the show itself got a little weird for me. Is the go-home show, which they haven't announced anything for yet, because they never announce anything for Dynamite these days. Is Blood and Guts the go-home? Because if all of this is leading to Blood and Guts that's after All In, a lot of these matches, the people who are winning should not be winning in any ways. But they are definitely setting up for a Blood and Guts match because we keep on having these two groups of people coming into fighting with each other, even though they're in individual matches at All In. Right? And then you use the double cage match to set all these stipulations where, like, if the Young Bucks lose, they have to give up the EVP titles in the match, or they have to make that a stipulation. If Moxley loses, he has to settle for Texas Death in his match against Hangman or something. It feels like they're setting up all these phony stipulations to be settled in a Blood and Guts match next.
Right.
Not this Wednesday, but next Wednesday, that they haven't even announced yet. Otherwise, why the hell are we doing these ops run-ins for the Bucks when they're not
right?
Facing each other?
But this EVP titles thing, I hate this on multiple levels.
Yes.
One, you are calling the EVP titles, the way they're using it in sentences is reminiscent of a belt.
Yes.
You're referring to it as a belt. But beyond that, we always talk about this. You gotta be able to envision a bifurcated world in terms of outcomes, right? One where the Bucks retain power and one where the people who are challenging the Bucks win. And I have absolutely no imaginative vision of what Will Ospreay and Swerve Strickland as executive vice presidents of AEW would do. And if anything, I would submit to you that the out for this should have been Strickland and Ospreay saying, if we win, no active wrestlers can be vice presidents anymore, and instead we are going to put it to a board of directors. Me and Swerve spoke, and we got veterans like Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian and Dustin Rhodes, who's going to retire finally, like whoever. Right, you make a board of directors of former wrestlers who are on your roster, probably working as agents. And the point is that the baby faces are going to remove the dictator quality of the executive vice president,
well, who's also an active wrestler. Allow me to step in here, because this is where my pet peeve comes in. And once again, we haven't established the groundwork that the Bucks are really all that corrupt when it right. comes to being vice president. They do one thing for themselves every six months.
Yeah, they made themselves tag champions, right? And so all I'm saying is the sin's got to match the punishment. And at this point, all they got in terms of a sin is the Bucks put themselves in advantageous positions to win the tag titles again.
Apparently, this is coming to work at AEW is a hellscape of which we can't imagine, because the Bucks have ceremonial executive vice president things that they never really turned the screws on Tony Khan, who we all know is around because he's mentioned on camera time and time again as being the guy who's made this match. So if Tony Khan can trump the EVPs, how much of a horrible reign are the EVPs having within this fictional AEW?
Well, Jeff, occasionally they move a match that Tony Khan made from the second hour to the first hour. Think about that.
Exactly.
Which can you imagine?
Perhaps if we announced these matches a week in advance, it wouldn't matter what time they were on the card.
Did you see Will Ospreay having a lace up in the ring this week? He had to tie his own boots in the ring. That's how disheveled.
He had just parked his car and come in and go, oh, you're on right now, Mr. Ospreay.
Hold on. I want to go back to that segment, though, because, like, look, if you really want to show that the Bucks are on this reign of terror, right, and you want to make that segment kind of pop, I think it's hokey, but whatever. Okay, so the Bucks come out and they announce that they're going to have a match right now. Christian and Lee Johnson are licking their chops, and they're waiting out there. Ospreay goes down to the ring. Nana and Swerve should pull up about 5 minutes into this match because they haven't even arrived at the arena yet. And Nana should kind of toss Swerve his shirt, and Swerve comes down and makes the save here to help Ospreay get the win over Christian and Johnson, who are in control for the first 5 to 7 minutes of this match. If you want to make it look like the baby faces are caught flat-footed, that they're caught off guard, they got to be caught flat-footed. It cannot just be Swerve Strickland comes out and is putting on a shirt as he's walking out so that he can take off the shirt in 20 feet when he gets into the ring. Do you understand the difference here?
No, I do.
Up to the arena because you don't think your match is for another 90 minutes is much more dramatic than I need to put my shirt on now as I'm walking out the curtain. I didn't even have time to get my shirt on that I take off 30 feet from now.
Allow me to push back on this, because even that to me sends the wrong message that guys just decide to show up to work. Oh, I don't need to show up for the beginning of the show. I'm just going to drive on in whenever that
I didn't say this is a good premise.
I know you did, but it's like one of those things where it's like you're trying to fix a bad premise, and people will say, yeah, that works. And I'm going, no, it makes it seem like an unprofessional company where you can just roll in because you think your match is later in the show.
To your point, consistently Excalibur's telling me that this match was made by Tony Khan, who we speak of in fond tones, too. Oh, this is a great choice by Tony Khan to put on this match. I'm really excited to see these two. So, like, where is this reign of terror by the Bucks coming from? What is the nature of this reign of terror? Why And then last and certainly not least here, if Ospreay and Strickland win, what does that world look like?
I think I have an idea if you want it.
I think
eventually it turns into a swerve heel turn where he goes mad with power.
Oh, him and Nana become vice president, and then not yes. him and Nana. I mean, not for
like,
nothing.
Like Ospreay's kind of like hands off, whatever, but Swerve takes it seriously.
Right, but yeah, it's still lame stuff, and then I found myself scratching my head. There's several lines on this show where I just scratched my head. I forget who this week once again just randomly said this company sucked for the last year, but didn't really actually explain why. So, like, would you say that kind of loosely? I'm thinking it's in reference to, like, the Bucks and everything, but they didn't really nail that down. So you got to be precise on that one.
I still can't get over two things about the Hurt Syndicate. Number one, that we have this ridiculously long jet speed match where they eke out the win. The Hurt Syndicate come out, they destroy jet speed. And then MVP gets on the mic and goes, are there any tag team challengers out there? When supposedly jet speed are going to be your tag team challengers. But I think that's changed due to Collision last night. I think it's going to be a multi-way match because it looks like Christian and Nick Wayne are going to somehow be involved in a match too, but we'll see about that. But then we're also like,
oh man, this Mark Briscoe promo where he simultaneously, let me stop on this real quickly. This is a real fine piece of English here, Jeffrey. Mark Briscoe comes out and he opens up. What was the word of the day this week, Jeff?
Empathy.
Empathy. And he got the crowd to chant empathy, empathy, because as Mark Briscoe illustrated, you know, MJF's gone through a lot of bullying back when he was, you know, in high school and in middle school. They used to throw quarters at all the anti-Semitism stuff. You know, he's really been through it. And then how do we end this promo, babyface Mark Briscoe? By calling him Kosher Pickle and getting the same crowd that chanted empathy moments ago about the bullying to turn back around and scream kosher effing pickle at him, and we don't see some sort of incongruousness in just that structure, let alone the fact that I think Briscoe almost cut too close to the boat here, that this fact, like MJF glomming himself onto this faction, kind of has this sort of icky racial thing where MJF now has three guys who are helping him out or kind of as hired help as he pursues the big championship and they're all the second. It's all very icky.
Well, that's
it was
okay.
Not a good piece of business. And Mark Briscoe's supposed to be the babyface.
MJF's not getting any flow to his promos because MVP keeps interrupting him to do crowd heat segments. It's amazing. Watch the flow. There is no flow to the MJF heat segment.
I think that's by design.
You do?
Yes, okay. I think that MJF and MVP not clicking, like despite wanting to click, is kind of like the story they're going for.
Oh, God.
I know. It just all sucks, and it goes back to my original point when this all started, which is the Hurt Business as a faction, as a story, as a unit is better as just those three guys. And MJF really just, for me, adds a Chris Jericho energy of guy who's been added into an already hot operational faction that is not actually a value added to that faction that he's now glommed himself into.
Oh, I need to circle back because I know the other thing that was just incongruent and just drove me a little bit nuts. Is the Ballad of A.R. Fox, who, did you know he has a lot of momentum?
Losses? Yeah, no, he's been losing like shit, but like every time he loses, he's picking up speed. Like, you know, yeah, have you ever seen a log, like a turd roll downhill and it doesn't break up? It just gets faster as it's rolling downhill and it's covering itself in dirt and it tightens up.
And then we get 15 minutes of the Ballad of A.R. Fox in this Jet Speed versus A.R. Fox and Ricochet tag match, where the babyfaces have absolutely no compunction about beating the holy crap out of babyface A.R. Fox, who is reluctantly teaming with this scumbag Ricochet, who is not helping his partner in any way, and A.R. Fox is taking it to get more and more sympathy, and then he's just beat. And there's no emotional resonance. There's going to be no follow-up
Ricochet's character is like putsy at this point. Like this whole, like, I feel like the I want to get a faction together storyline, if it's even remotely serious, really can only stay at that beat for a week, maybe two. Like, after the first week, guy who's trying to get faction together has to have his first dude. Otherwise, yeah, he comes off as really effing lame. And at this point, Ricochet, whatever thing he was kind of getting from like the new heel character, now he comes off as a twerp. He, you know, like all of the mannerisms, the goofy jacket, the ha ha, all that stuff just comes off as twerpy. It doesn't come off as part of a big dickish guy who's got some power and some clout and some influence and like knows it now and is throwing his stroke around.
He's Max Caster.
Yes, it comes off as Max Caster. I'm the greatest wrestler in the world. Like, it's it doesn't come off as stroke. It comes off as delusion. And yes, like, that's a very, you know, it's a very different energy. I don't think that's what Ricochet was going for, but that's definitely where he's at this point.
I have no other points on my
If you
wanted to hit NXT, you can.
Look, NXT continues to be a show that's on every week on Tuesday, and this week was no exception. I don't have a ton of interesting stuff to say about this. I think Tony D'Angelo and the Channing Stack Lorenzo thing is just, this is a storyline that's way past its expiration date. Lash Legend struggled during that main event match, during those power spots. And it's one of these things where I don't even fully blame Lash anymore, because the agents need to be aware. They've seen her struggle with these same spots numerous times. So they either need to pull her aside and have her do training until you're convinced she can do these spots, or you have to have her pull these spots from her match formula. Like, she just shouldn't be going for these power moves. The flip of this too is, for the safety of the other people in this match, they should not have to leave their feet for someone like Lash Legend, who cannot protect them when they are off their feet and out of the control of their own physical person. Like, I get worried for these women. Like Jada Parker, when Lash was trying to lift her, good Lord, I worry for her, because Lash doesn't get good rotations on stuff. Lash doesn't get people up well. She doesn't have good grip on things. There might be something for her to do in wrestling, but I gotta tell you, man, we've watched the Lash Legend experiment for a long time now. And there was that little like, oh, she's gotten a little bit better. Yeah. And that stopped 9 months ago, maybe. Like a year ago. She's completely plateaued. And the plateau she's at is not safe for the other people she works with if Lash is going to keep working a match style wherein they want her to pick people up and throw people around and stuff. Like, if I was in the ring with a person at the talent level of Lash, I would not leave my feet for them. Mm-hmm. I just, you know what I mean?
I'll give my quick hits. I thought Trick and Briggs was pretty good. I find the writing out of Inamura of the Obafemi storyline ridiculous. Jasper Troy. I thought that was stupid.
That was so the only thing I hope is that Inamura comes back around and humbles Jasper Troy next week. Like, when it actually, I mean, and straight up, actually, A great way to heat up Inamura for the Obafemi match would be if Inamura, in a surprise, came back and actually beat Jasper Troy on his way to this title match.
And I thought, you know, look, the match didn't mean anything to me, but I thought Ashante the Adonis looked actually pretty good against Ricky Starks. I don't see a lot of upside in him whatsoever. Oh, and I liked Javon Evans and Tavion Heights. I thought they worked pretty well together.
I liked them. That
was the highlight of the week for me, was that match in terms of...
Agreed. Tavion continues to be an exceptional talent on this show. They got to find something better to do with this guy.
Yes, and the no quarter catch crew is dead. Split them up.
It's done.
Let Maddie Rankowski do something, or Rinse and Claire go do something with somebody else.
Or have her keep running around with her and Charlie, because honestly, they were the whole personality of that unit anyways. It's like the energy of that unit is Maddie's chippiness, Rinse and Claire's chippiness,
yes,
countervailing against Charlie Dempsey. And so like the idea of them being each other's weird managers, despite like kind of being an odd couple friends, is honestly the engine that was driving the car anyways. They don't actually need the other two.
Well, you say that and it's correct, and then you realize what a mistake it was to break up Chase U with Thea Hale and Andre Chase. Hale is lost right now doing this dumb story with Tatum Paxley and whatnot. I am watching this show and I am struggling at times. Like I am with you, the entire mob story, and now you have the Heritage Cup involved in there because Noam Dar's injured again.
Right.
I'm just like, I don't care about any. Tony is a hell of a wrestler. This gimmick is done because none of his underlings are remotely interesting.
No, it's even worse with Lorenzo coming out, still calling himself the underboss, dressed like the New York Yankees still, and then you have the Lorenzo scrubs, and those guys, the white t-shirt crew, it feels like we have thrown the Tony D'Angelo Mafia through a Xerox machine and just made copy after copy after copy. And now what you've gotten down to is like white t-shirt with black pants is my mob look. Like, you know, like they don't even, you know, it went from like full mafioso tux to like colored shirt.
And then the consigliere is a freaking D-Both, I'm sorry I hit you with the cup again, a hook. You know, and you're like, aren't you supposed to be the smart lawyer of this crew?
And then when D'Angelo hits him, it makes D'Angelo look stupid too.
Yes.
No, it's dramatic irony, Chris. No, he's not perceptive enough. He's supposed to be the guy who sees everything. That's why he's the boss.
Yes.
Yeah, a boss will be smart enough to understand the difference between intention and miscommunication instinctually. A schlub would not be able to distinguish those two things and come up swinging like, who did this to me? Who did this to me? Like a boss.
I'm sorry.
I think you hit me. How dare you hit me, you dummy? Like that's three stooges shit, right? Like it's Mo getting up and going, you see this? Like, you know, what? Like,
jeez. He's not a visionary. He's not a luminary. Oh, let's end it there. Do you have anything else you wanted to bring up real quick?
I think we've hit it all.
We'll get Vader Club back and up and running next week. I'll pick something out early in the week and get Chris enough time to watch it. But you've been listening to Shake Them Ropes. We are part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. You can follow me on X at CrapGame13. You can just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word. I do a show over on Fight Game Media on Wednesdays called The Dynamite Show. About 20 minutes afterwards, Paul Fontaine and I thoroughly deconstruct that week's Dynamite. It's live on YouTube, but it drops in your podcatchers for free should you wish to listen to the audio version. Chris, I'm tired. Let's get this going.
Laugh, love. Dr. Nov, D-O-C-T-O-R.
Squalling and cratching. That's what
squalling,
I'm doing right now.
Yeah, scrying. It's scrying and clatching. Scrying. I remember my word, squalling. Anyways, point is, Dr. Nov, Instagram. Subscribe on Spotify. The The album is expanding in length unintentionally. I ended up finishing yet another song. So there are now 16, there'll be 16 tracks in the finished album. 14 of them are done, leaving only two left, which if for the love of God, I could write lyrics to them, this whole thing would be done. But it will be out sometime this summer. Go ahead, sub up now on Spotify. You can hear some of the old tracks. You'll be able to hear new mixes of them with like new parts and all that stuff too. On Spotify sometime over this summer.
Squad. Gee, boss.
No, who hit me? You can't do this to me. I'm a mafia boss.
Sorry.
My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines. And we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same Game Parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.